to live in balance with the world around you, maybe your path goes all the way out to Mars.
I think it does, Grandfather. Al clasped his grandson's shoulder.
Then go in duty, son.
Jamie smiled back at him. He knew his grandfather would understand. Now he had to break the news to his parents back in Berkeley.
Voznesensky personally checked each scientist's hard suit and backpack. Only when he was satisfied did he slide the transparent visor of his own helmet down and lock it in place.
At last the time has come,
he said, in almost accentless English, like a computer's voice synthesis. All the others locked their visors down. Connors, standing by the heavy metal hatch, leaned a gloved finger against the stud that activated the air pumps. Through the thick soles of his boots, Jamie felt them start chugging, saw the light on the airlock control panel turn from green to amber. Time seemed to stand still. For eternity, the pumps labored while the six explorers stood motionless and silent inside their brightly colored hard suits. With their visors down, Jamie could not see their faces, but he knew each of his fellow explorers by the color of their suits. Joanna was day glow orange, Ilona vivid green, Tony Reed canary yellow. The clattering of the pumps dwindled as the air was sucked out of the compartment until Jamie could hear nothing, not even his own breathing, because he was holding his breath in anticipation. The pumps stopped. The indicator light on the panel next to the hatch went to red. Connors pulled the lever, and the hatch popped open a crack. Voznesensky pushed it all the way open. Jamie felt lightheaded, as if he had climbed to the top of a mesa too fast or jogged a couple of miles in the thin air of the mountains. He let out his breath and took a deep gulp of his suit's air. It tasted cold and metal dry. Mars lay framed in the oval hatchway, glowing pink and red and auburn like the arid highlands where he had spent his childhood summers. Voznesensky was starting down the ladder, Jamie realized. Connors went down next, followed by Joanna, then Tony, Ilona, and finally himself. As if in a dream, Jamie went slowly down the ladder, one booted foot at a time, gloved hands sliding along the gleaming metal rails that ran between two of the unfolded petals of the aerobrake. Its ceramic-coated alloy had absorbed the blazing heat of their fiery entry into the Martian atmosphere. The metal mesh seemed dead cold now. Jamie stepped off the last rung of the flimsy ladder. He stood on the sandy surface of Mars. He felt totally alone. The five human figures beside him could not truly be people. They looked like strange, alien totems. Then he realized that they were aliens. And he was, too. Here on Mars, we are the alien invaders, Jamie told himself. He wondered if there were Martians hidden among the rocks, invisible to their eyes, watching them the way red men had watched the first whites step ashore onto their land centuries ago. He wondered what they would do about this alien invasion, and what the invaders would do if they found native life forms. In his helmet earphones, Jamie could hear the Russian team leader conversing with the expedition commander up in the orbiting spacecraft, his deep voice more excited than Jamie had ever heard before. Connors was checking the TV camera, perched up at the front of the stilled robot construction vehicle. Finally, Voznesensky spoke to his five charges as they arranged themselves in a semicircle around him.
All is ready. The words we speak next will be heard by everyone on Earth.
As planned, they stood with their backs to the landing vehicle while the robot's camera focused on them. Later, they would pan the vidcam around to show the newly erected dome and the desolate Martian plain on which they had set foot. Holding up one gloved hand, almost like a symphony conductor, Voznesensky took a self-conscious half-step forward and pronounced,
"In the name of Konstantin Eduardovich Tsiolkovsky, a Sergei Pavlovich Korolev, of Yuri Alexeyevich Gagarin, and of all the other pioneers and heroes of space, we come to Mars in peace for the advancement of all human peoples."
He said it in Russian first, and then in English. Only afterward were the others invited to recite their little pre-written speeches. Pete Connors, with the hint of Texan drawl he had picked up during his years at Houston, recited,
This is the greatest day in the history of human exploration, a proud day for all the people of the United States, the Soviet Union, and the whole world.
Joana Brumado spoke in Brazilian Portuguese and then in English.
May all the peoples of the earth gain in wisdom from what we learn here on Mars.
Ilona Molitor in Hebrew and then English.
We come to Mars to expand and exalt the human spirit.
Anthony Reed in his calm, almost bored Oxfordian vest.
To His Majesty the King, to the people of the United Kingdom and the British Commonwealth, to the people of the European Community and the entire world, today is your triumph. We deeply feel that we are merely your representatives on this distant world.
Finally, it was Jamie's turn. He felt suddenly weary, tired of the posturings and pomposities, exhausted by the years of stress and sacrifice. The excitement he had felt only minutes ago had drained away, evaporated. 100 million kilometers from Earth, and they were still playing their games of nations and allegiances. He felt as if someone had draped an enormous weight around his shoulders. The others all turned toward him, 5 faceless figures in hard suits and gold-tinted visors. Jamie saw his own faceless helmet reflected 5 times. He had already forgotten the lines that had been written for him 100 million kilometers ago. He said simply,
Yate.
Earth. Rio de Janeiro. It was bigger even than Carnival. Despite the scorching mid-afternoon sun, the crowds thronged downtown, from the municipal theater all the way up the mosaic sidewalks of the Avenida Rio Branco, past Praça Pio X and the magnificent old Candelaria Church, out along Avenida Presidente Vargas. Not a car or even a bicycle could get through. The streets were literally wall to wall with cariocas, dancing the samba, sweating, laughing, staggering in the heat, celebrating in the biggest spontaneous outpouring of joy that the city had ever seen. They jammed into the tree-shaded residential square where gigantic television screens had been set up in front of high-rise glass-walled apartment buildings. They stood on the benches in the square and clambered up the trees for a better view of the screens. They cheered and cried and shouted as they watched the space-suited explorers, one by one, climb down the ladder and stand on that barren, rocky desert beneath the strange pink sky. When Joana Brumado spoke her brief words, they cheered all the louder, drowning out the little speeches of those who followed her. Then they took up the chant, Brumado, 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 Brumado. Inside the apartment that had been lent to him for the occasion, Alberto Brumado smiled ruefully at his friends and associates. He had watched his daughter step onto the surface of Mars with a mixture of fatherly pride and anxiety that had brought tears to the corners of his eyes. "You must go out, Alberto," said the mayor of Rio. "They will not stop until you do." Large TV consoles had been wheeled into the 4 corners of the spacious high-ceilinged parlor. Only 12 people had been invited to share this moment of triumph with their famous countrymen, but more than 40 others had squeezed into the room. Many of the men were in evening clothes. The women wore their finest frocks and jewels. Later, Brumado and the select dozen would be whisked by helicopter to the airport and then on to Brasilia to be received by the President of the Republic. Outside, the people of Rio thundered, Brumado! Brumado! Alberto Brumado was a small, slight man. Well into his 60s, his dark, round face was framed by a neatly clipped, grizzled beard and short gray hair that seemed always tousled, as if he had just been engaged in some strenuous action. It was a kindly face, smiling, looking slightly nonplussed at the sudden insistence of the crowd outside. He was more accustomed to the quiet calm of the university classroom or the hushed intensity of the offices of the great and powerful. If the governments of the world's industrial nations were the brain directing the Mars project and the multinational corporations were the muscle, then Alberto Brumado was the heart of the mission to explore Mars. No, more still, Brumado was its soul. For more than 30 years, he had